This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, translated by Edith Grossman. This book is read by Armando Duran. For Mercedes, of course. The words I am about to express, they now have their own crowned goddess. Leandro Diaz. It was inevitable. The scent of bitter almonds always reminded him of the fate of unrequited love. Dr. Juvenal Urbino noticed it as soon as he entered the still darkened house where he had hurried on an urgent call to attend a case that for him had lost all urgency many years before. The Antillean refugee, Jeremia de San Amor, disabled war veteran, photographer of children, and his most sympathetic opponent in chess, had escaped the torments of memory with the aromatic fumes of gold cyanide. He found the corpse covered with a blanket on the campaign cot where he had always slept, and beside it was a stool with a developing tray he had used to vaporize the poison. On the floor, tied to a leg of the cot, lay the body of a black Great Dane with a snow-white chest, and next to him were the crutches. At one window, the splendor of dawn was just beginning to illuminate the stifling, crowded room that served as both bedroom and laboratory, but there was enough light for him to recognize at once the authority of death. The other windows, as well as every other chink in the room, were muffled with rags or sealed with black cardboard, which increased the oppressive heaviness. A counter was crammed with jars and bottles without labels, and two crumbling pewter trays under an ordinary light bulb covered with red paper. The third tray, the one for the fixative solution, was next to the body. There were old magazines and newspapers everywhere, piles of negatives on glass plates, broken furniture, but everything was kept free of dust by a diligent hand. Although the air coming through the window had purified the atmosphere, there still remained, for the one who could identify it, the dying embers of hapless love in the bitter almonds. Dr. Juvenal Urbino had often thought, with no premonitory intention, that this would not be a propitious place for dying in a state of grace. But in time, he came to suppose that perhaps its disorder obeyed an obscure determination of divine providence. A police inspector had come forward with a very young medical student who was completing his forensic training at the municipal dispensary, and it was they who had ventilated the room and covered the body while waiting for Dr. Urbino to arrive. They greeted him with a solemnity that on this occasion had more of condolence than veneration, for no one was unaware of the degree of his friendship with Jeremia de San Amor. The eminent teacher shook hands with each of them, as he always did with every one of his pupils before beginning the daily class in general clinical medicine, and then, as if it were a flower, he grasped the hem of the blanket with the tips of his index finger and his thumb, and slowly uncovered the body with sacramental circumspection. Jeremia de San Amor was completely naked, stiff and twisted, eyes open, body blue, looking 50 years older than he had the night before. He had luminous pupils, yellowish beard and hair, and an old scar sewn with baling knots across his stomach. The use of crutches had made his torso and arms as broad as a galley slave's, but his defenseless legs looked like an orphan's. Dr. Juvenal Urbino studied him for a moment, his heart aching as it rarely had in the long years of his futile struggle against death. "Damn fool," he said. "The worst was over." He covered him again with the blanket and regained his academic dignity. His 80th birthday had been celebrated the year before with an official 3-day jubilee, and in his thank-you speech he had once again resisted the temptation to retire. He had said, "I'll have plenty of time to rest when I die, but this eventuality is not yet part of my plans." Although he heard less and less with his right ear, and leaned on a silver-handled cane to conceal his faltering steps, he continued to wear a linen suit, with a gold watch chain across his vest as smartly as he had in his younger years. His pasteur beard, the color of mother-of-pearl, and his hair, the same color, carefully combed back and with a neat part in the middle, were faithful expressions of his character. He compensated as much as he could for an increasingly disturbing erosion of memory by scribbling hurried notes on scraps of paper that ended in confusion in each of his pockets, as did the instruments, the bottles of medicine, and all the other things jumbled together in his crowded medical bag. He was not only the city's oldest and most illustrious physician, he was also its most fastidious man. Still, his too obvious display of learning and the disingenuous manner in which he used the power of his name had won him less affection than he deserved. His instructions to the inspector and the intern were precise and rapid. There was no need for an autopsy. The odor in the house was sufficient proof that the cause of death had been the cyanide vapors activated in the tray by some photographic acid. And Jeremia de San Amor knew too much about those matters for it to have been an accident. When the inspector showed some hesitation, he cut him off with the kind of remark that was typical of his manner. "Don't forget that I am the one who signs the death certificate." The young doctor was disappointed. He had never had the opportunity to study the effects of gold cyanide on a cadaver. Dr. Juvenal Urbino had been surprised that he had not seen him at the medical school, but he understood in an instant from the young man's easy blush and Andean accent that he was probably a recent arrival to the city. He said, "There is bound to be someone driven mad by love who will give you the chance one of these days." And only after he said it did he realize that, among the countless suicides he could remember, this was the first with cyanide that had not been caused by the sufferings of love. Then something changed in the tone of his voice. "And when you do find one, observe with care," he said to the intern. "They almost always have crystals in their heart." Then he spoke to the inspector as he would have to a subordinate. He ordered him to circumvent all the legal procedures so that the burial could take place that same afternoon, and with the greatest discretion. He said, "I will speak to the mayor later." He knew that Jeremia de San Amor lived in primitive austerity, and that he had earned much more with his art than he needed, so that in one of the drawers in the house there was bound to be more than enough money for the funeral expenses. "But if you do not find it, it does not matter," he said. "I will take care of everything." He ordered him to tell the press that the photographer had died of natural causes, although he thought the news would in no way interest them. He said, "If it is necessary, I will speak to the governor." The inspector, a serious and humble civil servant, knew that the doctor's sense of civic duty exasperated even his closest friends, and he was surprised at the ease with which he skipped over legal formalities in order to expedite the burial. The only thing he was not willing to do was speak to the archbishop so that Jeremia de San Amor could be buried in holy ground. The inspector, astonished at his own impertinence, attempted to make excuses for him. "I understood this man was a saint," he said. "Something even rarer," said Dr. Urbino. "An atheistic saint. But those are matters for God to decide." In the distance, on the other side of the colonial city, the bells of the cathedral were ringing for high mass. Dr. Urbino put on his half-moon glasses with the gold rims and consulted the watch on its chain, slim, elegant, with a cover that opened at a touch. He was about to miss Pentecost Mass. In the parlor was a huge camera on wheels, like the ones used in public parks, and the backdrop of a marine twilight painted with homemade paints, and the walls papered with pictures of children at memorable moments. The First Communion, the bunny costume, the happy birthday. Year after year, during contemplative pauses on afternoons of chess, Dr. Urbino had seen the gradual covering over of the walls, and he had often thought, with a shudder of sorrow, that in the gallery of casual portraits lay the germ of the future city, governed and corrupted by those unknown children, where not even the ashes of his glory would remain. On the desk, next to a jar that held several old sea dogs' pipes, was the chessboard with an unfinished game. Despite his haste and his somber mood, Dr. Urbino could not resist the temptation to study it. He knew it was the previous night's game, for Jeremia de San Amor played at dusk every day of the week with at least three different opponents. But he always finished every game, and then placed the board and chessmen in their box, and stored the box in a desk drawer. The doctor knew he played with the white pieces, and that this time it was evident he was going to be defeated without mercy in four moves. If there had been a crime, this would be a good clue, Urbino said to himself. I know only one man capable of devising this masterful trap. If his life depended on it, he had to find out later why that indomitable soldier, accustomed to fighting to the last drop of blood, had left the final battle of his life unfinished. At 6 that morning, as he was making his last rounds, the night watchman had seen the note nailed to the street door. Come in without knocking and inform the police. A short while later, the inspector arrived with the intern, and the two of them had searched the house for some evidence that might contradict the unmistakable breath of bitter almonds. But in the brief minutes the doctor needed to study the unfinished game, the inspector discovered an envelope among the papers on the desk, addressed to Dr. Juvenal Urbino, and sealed with so much sealing wax that it had to be ripped to pieces to get the letter out. The doctor opened the black curtain over the window to have more light, gave a quick glance at the 11 sheets covered on both sides by a diligent handwriting, and when he had read the first paragraph, he knew that he would miss Pentecost communion. He read with agitated breath, turning back on several pages to find the thread he had lost, and when he finished, he seemed to return from very far away and very long ago. His despondency was obvious, despite his effort to control it. His lips were as blue as the corpse, and he could not stop the trembling of his fingers as he refolded the letter and placed it in his vest pocket. Then he remembered the inspector and the young doctor, and he smiled at them through the mists of grief. "Nothing in particular," he said. "His final instructions." It was a half-truth, but they thought it complete because he ordered them to lift a loose tile from the floor, where they found a worn account book that contained the combination to the strongbox. There was not as much money as they expected, but it was more than enough for the funeral expenses and to meet other minor obligations. Then Dr. Urbino realized that he could not get to the cathedral before the gospel reading. "It's the third time I've missed Sunday Mass since I've had the use of my reason," he said. "But God understands." So he chose to spend a few minutes more and attend to all the details, although he could hardly bear his intense longing to share the secrets of the letter with his wife. He promised to notify the numerous Caribbean refugees who lived in the city, in case they wanted to pay their last respects to the man who had conducted himself as if he were the most respectable of them all, the most active, and the most radical, even after it had become all too clear that he had been overwhelmed by the burden of disillusion. He would also inform his chess partners, who ranged from distinguished professional men to nameless laborers, as well as other, less intimate acquaintances who might perhaps wish to attend the funeral. Before he read the posthumous letter, he had resolved to be first among them, but afterward he was not certain of anything. In any case, he was going to send a wreath of gardenias in the event that Jeremia de San Amor had repented at the last moment. The burial would be at 5, which was the most suitable hour during the hottest months. If they needed him, from noon on he would be at the country house of Dr. Lacides Oliveira, his beloved disciple, who was celebrating his silver anniversary in the profession with a formal luncheon that day. Once the stormy years of his early struggles were over, Dr. Juvenal Urbino had followed a set routine and achieved a respectability and prestige that had no equal in the province. He arose at the crack of dawn when he began to take his secret medicines, potassium bromide to raise his spirits, salicylates for the ache in his bones when it rained, ergosterol drops for vertigo, belladonna for sound sleep. He took something every hour, always in secret, because in his long life as a doctor and teacher he had always opposed prescribing palliatives for old age. It was easier for him to bear other people's pains than his own. In his pocket he always carried a little pad of camphor that he inhaled deeply when no one was watching to calm his fear of so many medicines mixed together. He would spend an hour in his study preparing for the class in general clinical medicine that he taught at the medical school every morning, Monday through Saturday at 8 o'clock, until the day before his death. He was also an avid reader of the latest books that his bookseller in Paris mailed to him, or the ones from Barcelona that his local bookseller ordered for him, although he did not follow Spanish literature as closely as French. In any case, he never read them in the morning, but only for an hour after his siesta and at night before he went to sleep. When he was finished in the study, he did 15 minutes of respiratory exercises in front of the open window in the bathroom, always breathing toward the side where the roosters were crowing, which was where the air was new. Then he bathed, arranged his beard and waxed his mustache in an atmosphere saturated with genuine cologne from Farina Gegenüber, and dressed in white linen, with a vest and a soft hat and cordovan boots. At 81 years of age, he preserved the same easy-going manner and festive spirit that he had on his return from Paris soon after the great cholera epidemic. And except for the metallic color, his carefully combed hair with the center part was the same as it had been in his youth. He breakfasted en famille, but followed his own personal regimen of an infusion of wormwood blossoms for his stomach and a head of garlic that he peeled and ate a clove at a time, chewing each one carefully with bread to prevent heart failure. After class, it was rare for him not to have an appointment related to his civic initiatives or his Catholic service or his artistic and social innovations. He almost always ate lunch at home, and he had a 10-minute siesta on the terrace in the patio, hearing in his sleep the songs of the servant girls under the leaves of the mango trees, the cries of vendors on the street, the uproar of oil and motors from the bay, whose exhaust fumes fluttered through the house on hot afternoons like an angel condemned to putrefaction. Then he read his new books for an hour, above all novels and works of history, and gave lessons in French and singing to the tame parrot who had been a local attraction for years. At 4 o'clock, after drinking a large glass of lemonade with ice, he left to call on his patients. In spite of his age, he would not see patients in his office, and continued to care for them in their homes, as he always had, since the city was so domesticated that one could go anywhere in safety. After he returned from Europe the first time, he used the family landau drawn by 2 golden chestnuts. But when this was no longer practical, he changed it for a Victoria and a single horse, and he continued to use it with a certain disdain for fashion when carriages had already begun to disappear from the world, and the only ones left in the city were for giving rides to tourists and carrying wreaths at funerals. Although he refused to retire, he was aware that he was called in only for hopeless cases, but he considered this a form of specialization too. He could tell what was wrong with a patient just by looking at him. He grew more and more distrustful of patent medicines, and he viewed with alarm the vulgarization of surgery. He would say, "The scalpel is the greatest proof of the failure of medicine." He thought that, in a strict sense, all medication was poison, and that 70% of common foods hastened death. "In any case," he would say in class, "the little medicine we know is known only by a few doctors." From youthful enthusiasm, he had moved to a position that he himself defined as fatalistic humanism. "Each man is master of his own death, and all that we can do when the time comes is to help him die without fear of pain." But despite these extreme ideas, which were already part of local medical folklore, his former pupils continued to consult him even after they were established in the profession, for they recognized in him what was called in those days a clinical eye. In any event, he was always an expensive and exclusive doctor, and his patients were concentrated in the ancestral homes in the district of the viceroys. His daily schedule was so methodical that his wife knew where to send him a message if an emergency arose in the course of the afternoon. When he was a young man, he would stop in the parish cafe before coming home, and this was where he perfected his chess game with his father-in-law's cronies and some Caribbean refugees. But he had not returned to the parish cafe since the dawn of the new century, and he had attempted to organize national tournaments under the sponsorship of the social club. It was at this time that Jeremiah de San Amor arrived, his knees already dead, not yet a photographer of children. Yet in less than 3 months, everyone who knew how to move a bishop across a chessboard knew who he was, because no one had been able to defeat him in a game. For Dr. Juvenal Urbino, it was a miraculous meeting. At the very moment when chess had become an unconquerable passion for him, and he no longer had many opponents who could satisfy it. Thanks to him, Jeremiah de San Amor could become what he was among us. Dr. Urbino made himself his unconditional protector, his guarantor in everything, without even taking the trouble to learn who he was, or what he did, or what inglorious wars he had come from in his crippled, broken state. He eventually lent him the money to set up his photography studio, and from the time he took his first picture of a child startled by the magnesium flash, Jeremiah de San Amor paid back every last penny with religious regularity. It was all for chess. At first they played after supper at 7 o'clock, with a reasonable handicap for Jeremiah de San Amor because of his notable superiority. But the handicap was reduced until at last they played as equals. Later, when Don Galileo da Conte opened the first outdoor cinema, Jeremiah de San Amor was one of his most dependable customers, and the games of chess were limited to the nights when a new film was not being shown. By then, he and the doctor had become such good friends that they would go to see the films together, but never with the doctor's wife, in part because she did not have the patience to follow the complicated plot lines, and in part because it always seemed to her, through sheer intuition, that Jeremiah de San Amor was not a good companion for anyone. His Sundays were different. He would attend high mass at the cathedral and then return home to rest and read on the terrace in the patio. He seldom visited a patient on a holy day of obligation unless it was of extreme urgency, and for many years he had not accepted a social engagement that was not obligatory. On this Pentecost, in a rare coincidence, two extraordinary events had occurred: the death of a friend and the silver anniversary of an eminent pupil. Yet instead of going straight home as he had intended after certifying the death of Jeremiah de San Amor, he allowed himself to be carried along by curiosity. As soon as he was in his carriage, he again consulted the posthumous letter, and told the coachman to take him to an obscure location in the old slave quarter. That decision was so foreign to his usual habits that the coachman wanted to make certain there was no mistake. No, no mistake. The address was clear, and the man who had written it had more than enough reason to know it very well. Then Dr. Urbino returned to the first page of the letter, and plunged once again into the flood of unsavory revelations that might have changed his life, even at his age, if he could have convinced himself that they were not the ravings of a dying man. The sky had begun to threaten very early in the day, and the weather was cloudy and cool, but there was no chance of rain before noon. In his effort to find a shorter route, the coachman braved the rough cobblestones of the colonial city, and had to stop often to keep the horse from being frightened by the rowdiness of the religious societies and fraternities coming back from the Pentecost liturgy. The streets were full of paper garlands, music, flowers, and girls with colored parasols and muslin ruffles who watched the celebration from their balconies. In the plaza of the cathedral, where the statue of the Liberator was almost hidden among the African palm trees and the globes of the new streetlights, traffic was congested because Mass had ended, and not a seat was empty in the venerable and noisy parish café. Dr. Urbino's was the only horse-drawn carriage. It was distinguishable from the handful left in the city, because the patent leather roof was always kept polished, and it had fittings of bronze that would not be corroded by salt, and wheels and poles painted red with gilt trimming like gala nights at the Vienna Opera. Furthermore, while the most demanding families were satisfied if their drivers had a clean shirt, he still required his coachman to wear livery of faded velvet and a top hat like a circus ringmaster's, which, more than an anachronism, was thought to show a lack of compassion in the dog days of the Caribbean summer. Despite his almost maniacal love for the city, and a knowledge of it superior to anyone's, Dr. Juvenal Urbino had not often had reason, as he did that Sunday, to venture boldly into the tumult of the old slave quarter. The coachman had to make many turns and stop to ask directions several times in order to find the house. As they passed by the marshes, Dr. Urbino recognized their oppressive weight, their ominous silence, their suffocating gases, which on so many insomniac dawns had risen to his bedroom, blending with the fragrance of jasmine from the patio, and which he felt pass by him like a wind out of yesterday that had nothing to do with his life. But that pestilence, so frequently idealized by nostalgia, became an unbearable reality when the carriage began to lurch through the quagmire of the streets, where buzzards fought over the slaughterhouse offal as it was swept along by the receding tide. Unlike the city of the viceroys, where the houses were made of masonry, here they were built of weathered boards and zinc roofs, and most of them rested on pilings to protect them from the flooding of the open sewers that had been inherited from the Spaniards. Everything looked wretched and desolate. But out of the sordid taverns came the thunder of riotous music, the godless, drunken celebration of Pentecost by the poor. By the time they found the house, gangs of ragged children were chasing the carriage and ridiculing the theatrical finery of the coachman, who had to drive them away with his whip. Dr. Urbino, prepared for a confidential visit, realized too late that there was no innocence more dangerous than the innocence of age. The exterior of the unnumbered house was in no way distinguishable from its less fortunate neighbors, except for the window with lace curtains and an imposing front door taken from some old church. The coachman pounded the door knocker, and only when he had made certain that it was the right house did he help the doctor out of the carriage. The door opened without a sound, and in the shadowy interior stood a mature woman dressed in black with a red rose behind her ear. Despite her age, which was no less than 40, she was still a haughty mulatta with cruel golden eyes and hair tight to her skull like a helmet of steel wool. Dr. Urbino did not recognize her, although he had seen her several times in the gloom of the chess games in the photographer's studio, and he had once written her a prescription for tertian fever. He held out his hand, and she took it between hers, less in greeting than to help him into the house. The parlor had the climate and invisible murmur of a forest glade, and was crammed with furniture and exquisite objects, each in its natural place. Dr. Urbino recalled, without bitterness, an antiquarian's shop, number 26 Rue Montmartre in Paris, on an autumn Monday in the last century. The woman sat down across from him, and spoke in accented Spanish. "This is your house, doctor," she said. "I did not expect you so soon." Dr. Urbino felt betrayed. He stared at her openly, at her intense mourning, at the dignity of her grief, and then he understood that this was a useless visit, because she knew more than he did about everything stated and explained in Jeremiah de San Amor's posthumous letter. This was true. She had been with him until a very few hours before his death, as she had been with him for half his life, with a devotion and submissive tenderness that bore too close a resemblance to love, and without anyone knowing anything about it in this sleepy provincial capital, where even state secrets were common knowledge. They had met in a convalescent home in Port-au-Prince, where she had been born and where he had spent his early years as a fugitive, and she had followed him here a year later for a brief visit, although both of them knew, without agreeing to anything, that she had come to stay forever. She cleaned and straightened the laboratory once a week, but not even the most evil-minded neighbors confused appearance with reality because they, like everyone else, supposed that Jeremiah de San Amor's disability affected more than his capacity to walk. Dr. Urbino himself supposed as much for solid medical reasons, and never would have believed his friend had a woman if he himself had not revealed it in the letter. In any event, it was difficult for him to comprehend that two free adults without a past and living on the fringes of a closed society's prejudices had chosen the hazards of illicit love. She explained, it was his wish. Moreover, a clandestine life shared with a man who was never completely hers and in which they often knew the sudden explosion of happiness did not seem to her a condition to be despised. On the contrary, life had shown her that perhaps it was exemplary. On the previous night they had gone to the cinema, each one separately, and had sat apart as they had done at least twice a month since the Italian immigrant Don Galileo da Conte had installed his open-air theater in the ruins of a 17th-century convent. They saw All Quiet on the Western Front, a film based on a book that had been popular the year before and that Dr. Urbino had read, his heart devastated by the barbarism of war. They met afterward in the laboratory. She found him brooding and nostalgic, and thought it was because of the brutal scenes of wounded men dying in the mud. In an attempt to distract him, she invited him to play chess, and he accepted, to please her, but he played inattentively, with the white pieces, of course, until he discovered before she did that he was going to be defeated in four moves and surrendered without honor. Then the doctor realized that she had been his opponent in the final game, and not General Jeronimo Argote, as he had supposed. He murmured in astonishment, "It was masterful." She insisted that she deserved no praise, but rather that Jeremiah de San Amor, already lost in the mists of death, had moved his pieces without love. When he stopped the game at about 11:15, for the music from the public dances had ended, he asked her to leave him. He wanted to write a letter to Dr. Juvenal Urbino, whom he considered the most honorable man he had ever known, and his soul's friend, as he liked to say, despite the fact that the only affinity between the two was their addiction to chess, understood as a dialogue of reason and not as a science. And then she knew that Jeremiah de San Amor had come to the end of his suffering, and that he had only enough life left to write the letter. The doctor could not believe it. "So then you knew," he exclaimed. She not only knew, she agreed, but she had helped him to endure the suffering as lovingly as she had helped him to discover happiness. Because that was what his last 11 months had been. Cruel suffering. "Your duty was to report him," said the doctor. "I could not do that," she said, shocked. "I loved him too much." Dr. Urbino, who thought he had heard everything, had never heard anything like that, and said with such simplicity. He looked straight at her and tried with all his senses to fix her in his memory as she was at that moment. She seemed like a river idol, undaunted in her black dress, with her serpent's eyes and the rose behind her ear. A long time ago, on a deserted beach in Haiti, where the two of them lay naked after love, Jeremiah de San Amor had sighed, "I will never be old." She interpreted this as a heroic determination to struggle without quarter against the ravages of time, but he was more specific. He had made the irrevocable decision to take his own life when he was 60 years old. He had turned 60, in fact, on the 23rd of January of that year, and then he had set the date as the night before Pentecost, the most important holiday in a city consecrated to the cult of the Holy Spirit. There was not a single detail of the previous night that she had not known about ahead of time, and they spoke of it often, suffering together the irreparable rush of days that neither of them could stop now. Jeremiah de San Amor loved life with a senseless passion. He loved the sea and love. He loved his dog and her, and as the date approached, he had gradually succumbed to despair, as if his death had been not his own decision, but an inexorable destiny. Last night, when I left him, he was no longer of this world, she said. She had wanted to take the dog with her, but he looked at the animal dozing beside the crutches and caressed him with the tips of his fingers. He said, I'm sorry, but Mr. Woodrow Wilson is coming with me. He asked her to tie him to the leg of the cot while he wrote, and she used a false knot so that he could free himself. That had been her only act of disloyalty, and it was justified by her desire to remember the master in the wintry eyes of his dog. But Dr. Urbino interrupted her to say that the dog had not freed himself. She said, Then it was because he did not want to. And she was glad, because she preferred to evoke her dead lover as he had asked her to the night before, when he stopped writing the letter he had already begun and looked at her for the last time. Remember me with a rose, he said to her. She had returned home a little after midnight. She lay down fully dressed on her bed to smoke one cigarette after another and give him time to finish what she knew was a long and difficult letter, and a little before 3 o'clock, when the dogs began to howl, she put the water for coffee on the stove, dressed in full mourning, and cut the first rose of dawn in the patio. Dr. Urbino already realized how completely he would repudiate the memory of that irredeemable woman, and he thought he knew why. Only a person without principles could be so complacent toward grief. And for the remainder of the visit, she gave him even more justification. She would not go to the funeral, for that is what she had promised her lover, although Dr. Urbino thought he read just the opposite in one of the paragraphs of the letter. She would not shed a tear. She would not waste the rest of her years simmering in the maggot broth of memory. She would not bury herself alive inside these four walls to sew her shroud, as native widows were expected to do. She intended to sell Jeremiah de San Amor's house and all its contents, which, according to the letter, now belonged to her, and she would go on living as she always had, without complaining, in this death trap of the poor, where she had been happy. The words pursued Dr. Juvenal Urbino on the drive home. This death trap of the poor. It was not a gratuitous description. For the city, his city, stood unchanging on the edge of time. The same burning dry city of his nocturnal terrors and the solitary pleasures of puberty, where flowers rusted and salt corroded, where nothing had happened for 4 centuries except a slow aging among withered laurels and putrefying swamps. In winter, sudden devastating downpours flooded the latrines and turned the streets into sickening bogs. In summer, an invisible dust as harsh as red-hot chalk was blown into even the best-protected corners of the imagination by mad winds that took the roofs off the houses and carried away children through the air. On Saturdays, the poor mulattoes, along with all their domestic animals and kitchen utensils, tumultuously abandoned their hovels of cardboard and tin on the edges of the swamps, and in jubilant assault, took over the rocky beaches of the colonial district. Until a few years ago, some of the older ones still bore the royal slave brand that had been burned onto their chests with flaming irons. During the weekend, they danced without mercy, drank themselves blind on home-brewed alcohol, made wild love among the icaco plants, and on Sunday at midnight, they broke up their own party with bloody free-for-alls. During the rest of the week, the same impetuous mob swarmed into the plazas and alleys of the old neighborhoods with their stores of everything that could be bought and sold, and they infuse the dead city with the frenzy of a human fair reeking of fried fish. A new life. Independence from Spain, and then the abolition of slavery, precipitated the conditions of honorable decadence in which Dr. Juvenal Urbino had been born and raised. The great old families sank into their ruined palaces in silence. Along the rough cobbled streets that had served so well in surprise attacks and buccaneer landings, weeds hung from the balconies and opened cracks in the whitewashed walls of even the best-kept mansions. And the only signs of life at 2 o'clock in the afternoon were languid piano exercises played in the dim light of siesta. Indoors, in the cool bedrooms saturated with incense, women protected themselves from the sun as if it were a shameful infection, and even at early mass, they hid their faces in their mantillas. Their love affairs were slow and difficult, and were often disturbed by sinister omens, and life seemed interminable. At nightfall, at the oppressive moment of transition, a storm of carnivorous mosquitoes rose out of the swamps, and a tender breath of human shit, warm and sad, stirred the certainty of death in the depths of one's soul. And so, the very life of the colonial city, which the young Juvenal Urbino tended to idealize in his Parisian melancholy, was an illusion of memory. In the 18th century, the commerce of the city had been the most prosperous in the Caribbean, owing in the main to the thankless privilege of its being the largest African slave market in the Americas. It was also the permanent residence of the viceroys of the new kingdom of Granada, who preferred to govern here on the shores of the world's ocean, rather than in the distant freezing capital under a centuries-old drizzle that disturbed their sense of reality. Several times a year, fleets of galleons carrying the treasures of Potosí, Quito, and Veracruz gathered in the bay, and the city lived its years of glory. On Friday, June 8, 1708, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the galleon San José set sail for Cádiz with a cargo of precious stones and metals valued at 500 billion pesos in the currency of the day. It was sunk by an English squadron at the entrance to the port, and 2 long centuries later it had not yet been salvaged. That treasure, lying in its bed of coral and the corpse of the commander floating sideways on the bridge, were evoked by historians as an emblem of the city drowned in memories. Across the bay, in the residential district of La Manga, Dr. Juvenal Urbino's house stood in another time. One story, spacious and cool, it had a portico with Doric columns on the outside terrace, which commanded a view of the still, miasmic water and the debris from sunken ships in the bay. From the entrance door to the kitchen, the floor was covered with black and white checkerboard tiles, a fact often attributed to Dr. Urbino's ruling passion, without taking into account that this was a weakness common to the Catalonian craftsmen who built this district for the Nouveau Riche at the beginning of the century. The large drawing room had the very high ceilings found throughout the rest of the house, and 6 full-length windows facing the street, and it was separated from the dining room by an enormous, elaborate glass door covered with branching vines and bunches of grapes and maidens seduced by the pipes of fauns in a bronze grove. The furnishings in the reception rooms, including the pendulum clock that stood like a living sentinel in the drawing room, were all original English pieces from the late 19th century, and the lamps that hung from the walls were all teardrop crystal, and there were Sèvres vases and bowls everywhere, and little alabaster statues of pagan idols. But that European coherence vanished in the rest of the house, where wicker armchairs were jumbled together with Viennese rockers and leather footstools made by local craftsmen. Splendid hammocks from San Jacinto, with multicolored fringe along the sides and the owner's name embroidered in Gothic letters with silk thread, hung in the bedrooms, along with the beds. Next to the dining room, the space that had originally been designed for gala suppers was used as a small music room for intimate concerts when famous performers came to the city. In order to enhance the silence, the tiles had been covered with the Turkish rugs purchased at the World's Fair in Paris. A recent model of a Victrola stood next to a stand that held records arranged with care, and in a corner, draped with a manila shawl, was the piano that Dr. Urbino had not played for many years. Throughout the house, one could detect the good sense and care of a woman whose feet were planted firmly on the ground. But no other room displayed the meticulous solemnity of the library, the sanctuary of Dr. Urbino until old age carried him off. There, all around his father's walnut desk and the tufted leather easy chairs, he had lined the walls and even the windows with shelves behind glass doors, and had arranged in an almost demented order the 3,000 volumes bound in identical calfskin with his initials in gold on the spines. Unlike the other rooms, which were at the mercy of noise and foul winds from the port, the library always enjoyed the tranquility and fragrance of an abbey. Born and raised in the Caribbean superstition that one opened doors and windows to summon a coolness that in fact did not exist, Dr. Urbino and his wife at first felt their hearts oppressed by enclosure. But in the end, they were convinced of the merits of the Roman strategy against heat, which consists of closing houses during the lethargy of August in order to keep out the burning air from the street, and then opening them up completely to the night breezes. And from that time on, theirs was the coolest house under the furious La Manga sun. And it was a delight to take a siesta in the darkened bedrooms and to sit on the portico in the afternoon to watch the heavy ash-gray freighters from New Orleans pass by, and at dusk to see the wooden paddles of the riverboats with their shining lights purifying the stagnant garbage heap of the bay with the wake of their music. It was also the best protected from December through March, when the northern winds tore away roofs and spent the night circling like hungry wolves, looking for a crack where they could slip in. No one ever thought that a marriage rooted in such foundations could have any reason not to be happy. In any case, Dr. Urbino was not, when he returned home that morning before 10 o'clock, shaken by the two visits that not only had obliged him to miss Pentecost Mass, but also threatened to change him at an age when everything had seemed complete. He wanted a short siesta until it was time for Dr. Lacides Oliveira's gala luncheon, but he found the servants in an uproar as they attempted to catch the parrot, who had flown to the highest branches of the mango tree when they took him from his cage to clip his wings. He was a deplumed, maniacal parrot, who did not speak when asked to, but only when it was least expected, but then he did so with a clarity and rationality that were uncommon among human beings. He had been tutored by Dr. Urbino himself, which afforded him privileges that no one else in the family ever had, not even the children when they were young. He had lived in the house for over 20 years, and no one knew how many years he had been alive before then. Every afternoon after his siesta, Dr. Urbino sat with him on the terrace in the patio, the coolest spot in the house, and he had summoned the most diligent reserves of his passion for pedagogy until the parrot learned to speak French like an academician. Then, just for the love of the labor, he taught him the Latin accompaniment to the Mass and selected passages from the Gospel according to St. Matthew, and he tried without success to inculcate in him a working notion of the four arithmetic functions. On one of his last trips to Europe, he brought back the first phonograph with a trumpet speaker, along with many of the latest popular records, as well as those by his favorite classical composers. Day after day, over and over again for several months, he played the songs of Yvette Guilbert and Aristide Brouin, who had charmed France during the last century, until the parrot learned them by heart. He sang them in a woman's voice, if they were hers, in a tenor's voice, if they were his, and ended with impudent laughter that was a masterful imitation of the servant girls when they heard him singing in French. The fame of his accomplishments was so widespread that on occasion, distinguished visitors who had traveled from the interior on the riverboats would ask permission to see him. And once, some of the many English tourists, who in those days sailed the banana boats from New Orleans, would have bought him at any price. But the day of his greatest glory was when the President of the Republic, Don Marco Fidel Suarez, with his entourage of cabinet ministers, visited the house in order to confirm the truth of his reputation. They arrived at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, suffocating in the top hats and frock coats they had worn during 3 days of official visits under the burning August sky, and they had to leave as curious as when they arrived, because for 2 desperate hours the parrot refused to say a single syllable, ignoring the pleas and threats and public humiliation of Dr. Urbino, who had insisted on that foolhardy invitation despite the sage warnings of his wife. The fact that the parrot could maintain his privileges after that historic act of defiance was the ultimate proof of his sacred rights. No other animal was permitted in the house, with the exception of the land turtle who had reappeared in the kitchen after 3 or 4 years, when everyone thought he was lost forever. He, however, was not considered a living being, but rather a mineral good-luck charm, whose location one could never be certain of. Dr. Urbino was reluctant to confess his hatred of animals, which he disguised with all kinds of scientific inventions and philosophical pretexts that convinced many, but not his wife. He said that people who loved them to excess were capable of the worst cruelties toward human beings. He said that dogs were not loyal, but servile, that cats were opportunists and traitors, that peacocks were heralds of death, that macaws were simply decorative annoyances, that rabbits fomented greed, that monkeys carried the fever of lust, and that roosters were damned because they had been complicit in the 3 denials of Christ. On the other hand, Fermina Daza, his wife, who at that time was 72 years old and had already lost the doe's gait of her younger days, was an irrational idolater of tropical flowers and domestic animals, and early in her marriage she had taken advantage of the novelty of love to keep many more of them in the house than good sense would allow. The first were 3 Dalmatians named after Roman emperors, who fought for the favors of a female who did honor to her name of Messalina, for it took her longer to give birth to 9 pups than to conceive another 10. Then there were Abyssinian cats with the profiles of eagles and the manners of pharaohs, cross-eyed Siamese and palace Persians with orange eyes, who walked through the rooms like shadowy phantoms and shattered the night with the howling of their witches' sabbaths of love. For several years, an Amazonian monkey, chained by his waist to the mango tree in the patio, elicited a certain compassion, because he had the sorrowful face of Archbishop Obdulio Rey, the same candid eyes, the same eloquent hands. That, however, was not the reason Fermina got rid of him, but because he had the bad habit of pleasuring himself in honor of the ladies. There were all kinds of Guatemalan birds in cages along the passageways and promontory curlews, and swamp herons with long yellow legs, and a young stag who came in through the windows to eat the anthurium in the flower pots. Shortly before the last civil war, when there was talk for the first time of a possible visit by the Pope, they had brought a bird of paradise from Guatemala. But it took longer to arrive than to return to its homeland, when it was learned that the announcement of the pontifical visit had been a lie spread by the government to alarm the conspiratorial liberals. Another time, on the smugglers' ships from Curaçao, they bought a wicker cage with 6 perfumed crows, identical to the ones that Fermina Daza had kept as a girl in her father's house, and that she still wanted to have as a married woman. But no one could bear the continual flapping of their wings that filled the house with the reek of funeral wreaths. They also brought in an anaconda, 4 meters long, whose insomniac hunter's sighs disturbed the darkness in the bedrooms, although it accomplished what they had wanted, which was to frighten with its mortal breath the bats and salamanders and countless species of harmful insects that invaded the house during the rainy months. Dr. Juvenal Urbino, so occupied at that time with his professional obligations and so absorbed in his civic and cultural enterprises, was content to assume that in the midst of so many abominable creatures, his wife was not only the most beautiful woman in the Caribbean, but also the happiest. But one rainy afternoon, at the end of an exhausting day, he encountered a disaster in the house that brought him to his senses. Out of the drawing room, and as far as the eye could see, a stream of dead animals floated in a marsh of blood. The servant girls had climbed on the chairs, not knowing what to do, and they had not yet recovered from the panic of the slaughter. One of the German mastiffs, maddened by a sudden attack of rabies, had torn to pieces every animal of any kind that crossed its path until the gardener from the house next door found the courage to face him and hack him to pieces with his machete. No one knew how many creatures he had bitten or contaminated with his green slaverings, and so Dr. Urbino ordered the survivors killed and their bodies burned in an isolated field, and he requested the services of Misericordia Hospital for a thorough disinfecting of the house. The only animal to escape, because nobody remembered him, was the giant Lucky Charm tortoise. Fermina Dasa admitted for the first time that her husband was right in a domestic matter, and for a long while afterward she was careful to say no more about animals. She consoled herself with color illustrations from Linnaeus's Natural History, which she framed and hung on the drawing-room walls, and perhaps she would eventually have lost all hope of ever seeing an animal in the house again, if it had not been for the thieves, who early one morning forced a bathroom window and made off with the silver service that had been in the family for five generations. Dr. Urbino put double padlocks on the window frames, secured the doors on the inside with iron crossbars, placed his most valuable possessions in the strongbox, and belatedly acquired the wartime habit of sleeping with a revolver under his pillow. But he opposed the purchase of a fierce dog, vaccinated or unvaccinated, running loose or chained up, even if thieves were to steal everything he owned. "Nothing that does not speak will come into this house," he said. He said it to put an end to the specious arguments of his wife, who was once again determined to buy a dog, and he never imagined that his hasty generalization was to cost him his life. Fermina Dasa, whose straightforward character had become more subtle with the years, seized on her husband's casual words, and months after the robbery, she returned to the ships from Curaçao and bought a royal Paramaribo parrot, who knew only the blasphemies of sailors, but said them in a voice so human that he was well worth the extravagant price of 12 centavos. He was a fine parrot, lighter than he seemed, with a yellow head and a black tongue. The only way to distinguish him from mangrove parrots, who did not learn to speak even with turpentine suppositories. Dr. Urbino, a good loser, bowed to the ingenuity of his wife, and was even surprised at how amused he was by the advances the parrot made when he was excited by the servant girls. On rainy afternoons, his tongue loosened by the pleasure of having his feathers drenched, he uttered phrases from another time, which he could not have learned in the house, and which led one to think that he was much older than he appeared. The doctor's final doubts collapsed one night when the thieves tried to get in again through a skylight in the attic, and the parrot frightened them with a mastiff's barking that could not have been more realistic if it had been real, and with shouts of "Stop thief! Stop thief! Stop thief!" two saving graces he had not learned in the house. It was then that Dr. Urbino took charge of him and ordered the construction of a perch under the mango tree, with a container for water, another for ripe bananas, and a trapeze for acrobatics. From December through March, when the nights were cold and the north winds made living outdoors unbearable, he was taken inside to sleep in the bedrooms in a cage covered by a blanket. Although Dr. Urbino suspected that his chronic swollen glands might be a threat to the healthy respiration of humans. For many years, they clipped his wing feathers and let him wander wherever he chose to walk with his hulking old horseman's gait. But one day, he began to do acrobatic tricks on the beams in the kitchen, and fell into the pot of stew with a sailor's shout of "Every man for himself," and with such good luck that the cook managed to scoop him out with the ladle, scalded and deplumed, but still alive. From then on, he was kept in the cage even during the daytime, In defiance of the vulgar belief that caged parrots forget everything they have learned, and let out only in the 4 o'clock coolness for his classes with Dr. Urbino on the terrace in the patio. No one realized in time that his wings were too long, and they were about to clip them that morning when he escaped to the top of the mango tree. And for 3 hours they had not been able to catch him. The servant girls, with the help of other maids in the neighborhood, had used all kinds of tricks to lure him down, but he insisted on staying where he was, laughing madly as he shouted, "Long live the Liberal Party! Long live the Liberal Party, damn it!" a reckless cry that had cost many a carefree drunk his life. Dr. Urbino could barely see him amid the leaves, and he tried to cajole him in Spanish and French and even in Latin, and the parrot responded in the same languages and with the same emphasis and timbre in his voice, but he did not move from his treetop. Convinced that no one was going to make him move voluntarily, Dr. Urbino had them send for the fire department, his most recent civic pastime. Until just a short time before, in fact, fires had been put out by volunteers using brick masons' ladders and buckets of water carried in from wherever it could be found, and methods so disorderly that they sometimes caused more damage than the fires. But for the past year, thanks to a fund organized by the Society for Public Improvement, of which Juvenal Urbino was honorary president, there was a corps of professional firemen and a water truck with a siren and a bell and 2 high-pressure hoses. They were so popular that classes were suspended when the church bells were heard sounding the alarm, so the children could watch them fight the fire. At first, that was all they did. But Dr. Urbino told the municipal authorities that in Hamburg, he had seen firemen revive a boy found frozen in a basement after a 3-day snowstorm. He had also seen them in a Neapolitan alley lowering a corpse in his coffin from a 10th-floor balcony. Because the stairway in the building had so many twists and turns that the family could not get him down to the street. That was how the local firemen learned to render other emergency services, such as forcing locks or killing poisonous snakes, and the medical school offered them a special course in first aid for minor accidents. So it was in no way peculiar to ask them to please get a distinguished parrot with all the qualities of a gentleman out of a tree. Dr. Urbino said, "Tell them it's for me." And he went to his bedroom to dress for the gala luncheon. The truth was that at that moment, devastated by the letter from Jeremia de San Amor, he did not really care about the fate of the parrot. Fermina Daza had put on a loose-fitting silk dress belted at the hip, a necklace of real pearls with 6 long uneven loops, and high-heeled satin shoes that she wore only on very solemn occasions. For by now, she was too old for such abuses. Her stylish attire did not seem appropriate for a venerable grandmother, but it suited her figure, long-boned and still slender and erect, her resilient hands without a single age spot, her steel-blue hair bobbed on a slant at her cheek. Her clear almond eyes and her inborn haughtiness were all that were left to her from her wedding portrait. But what she had been deprived of by age, she more than made up for in character and diligence. She felt very well. The time of iron corsets, bound waists and bustles that exaggerated buttocks, was receding into the past. Liberated bodies, breathing freely, showed themselves for what they were, even at the age of 72. Dr. Urbino found her sitting at her dressing table under the slow blades of the electric fan, putting on her bell-shaped hat decorated with felt violets. The bedroom was large and bright, with an English bed protected by mosquito netting embroidered in pink, and 2 windows open to the trees in the patio, where one could hear the clamor of cicadas, giddy with premonitions of rain. Ever since their return from their honeymoon, Fermina Daza had chosen her husband's clothes according to the weather and the occasion, and laid them out for him on a chair the night before, so they would be ready for him when he came out of the bathroom. She could not remember when she had also begun to help him dress, and finally to dress him, and she was aware that at first she had done it for love, but for the past 5 years or so, she had been obliged to do it regardless of the reason because he could not dress himself. They had just celebrated their golden wedding anniversary, and they were not capable of living for even an instant without the other, or without thinking about the other, and that capacity diminished as their age increased. Neither could have said if their mutual dependence was based on love or convenience, but they had never asked the question with their hands on their hearts, because both had always preferred not to know the answer. Little by little, she had been discovering the uncertainty of her husband's step, his mood changes, the gaps in his memory, his recent habit of sobbing while he slept. But she did not identify these as the unequivocal signs of final decay, but rather as a happy return to childhood. That was why she did not treat him like a difficult old man, but as a senile baby. And that deception was providential for the two of them, because it put them beyond the reach of pity. Life would have been quite another matter for them both if they had learned in time that it was easier to avoid great matrimonial catastrophes than trivial everyday miseries. But if they had learned anything together, it was that wisdom comes to us when it can no longer do any good. For years, Fermina Daza had endured her husband's jubilant dawns with a bitter heart. She clung to the last threads of sleep in order to avoid facing the fatality of another morning full of sinister premonitions, while he awoke with the innocence of a newborn. Each new day was one more day he had won. She heard him awake with the roosters, and his first sign of life was a cough without rhyme or reason that seemed intended to awaken her too. She heard him grumble, just to annoy her, while he felt around for the slippers that were supposed to be next to the bed. She heard him make his way to the bathroom, groping in the dark. After an hour in his study, when she had fallen asleep again, he would come back to dress, still without turning on the light. Once, during a party game, he had been asked how he defined himself, and he had said,